Most of the time, I'm simply the resident expert on registration. The only other time that I can recall being on this stage, or the last time I can recall being on this stage, was in its pre-Werner days, when we used to conduct registration here in a series of four consecutive nights. I feel somewhat ill-equipped because I don't have a big, large black marker for closing off class sections. In response to one of the questions, Professor Longman made the remark that maybe I would say something about his reading of Isaiah 27:1. Well, no. I reassured him of that even at the end of his presentation. The appropriation by the prophet at that point of cosmic things, and indeed at a couple of other places in the framework of Isaiah 24 through 27, is something that has prompted the notation Isaiah Apocalypse, but it goes back to some of the things that were talked about in the conversation about what is it that the writers of the Old Testament knew at the time of their writing. And as far as I'm concerned, you simply can't rule out of bounds the fact that the writer of Isaiah 24 through 27 actually could have concepts like, or even mythical features like Leviathan in mind, and would understand that Yahweh is the Lord of the cosmos and not just God of Israel. Then, finally, as sort of a precursor and running right into my paper, when I look at the title, I realize that this is why I never or almost never did sermon titles, because there always seems to be something that, the title that I pick that then doesn't quite fit what I wrote. So it's on the writing of reading, or should I say it the other way around? Is it the reading of writing? There is a reciprocity or complementarity between reading and writing as they bear on communicative situations and acts, as they bear on what we familiarly call texts. This complementarity belongs to an interpretive challenge for Old Testament scholarship, an interpretive challenge of textuality, to use today's theme. What is text? Well, we might begin with Justice Potter Stewart's famous observation in his concurring opinion for the 1964 Supreme Court case on hardcore pornography. I shall not today attempt further to define the kinds of material I understand to be embraced within that shorthand description. And perhaps I could never succeed in intelligibly doing so, but I know it when I see it. We can denominate a text or the text, but defining the concept text has been considerably more elusive. In The Literary in Theory, Jonathan Culler discusses certain vicissitudes of text, beginning with traditional textual scholarship, where the notion of text, he writes, is that of a material object, but also of the very form of the work in its original ideal state. The colloquial notion of text is the writing that you see before you. But texts are of interest, above all, because of that which is or ought to be carried by or manifested in the material text, and texts are thus seldom identified unreservedly with what appears on paper. Stefan Alkier, a New Testament scholar who is pursuing a semiotic conception of biblical studies, appropriated the following definition of textuality from textual theorist Janos Petofi. For us, Petofi wrote, textuality is no inherent characteristic of verbal objects. A producer or a recipient regards a verbal object as text when he or she believes that this verbal object is a cohesive and complete whole that corresponds to an actual or assumed communicative intention in an actual or assumed communication situation. A text is, according to semiotic terminology, a complex verbal sign, or a verbal sign complex, that corresponds to a given expectation of textuality. Notice the dependence on producer and or recipient. The belief in correspondence by either the producer or the recipient can be characterized as an intentionality. And even if the intentionality of neither proves to be accessible, if we find ourselves unable to say unequivocally that this or that was the writer's intention or an original real reader's intention, intention still remains a necessary ingredient of textuality as a communicative act. On the Old Testament side, Archibald Van Wieringen never uses the S word, semiotics, in his The Reader-Oriented Unity of the Book, Isaiah, but his decision to pursue an approach based on a communication model has affinities with Petofi's definition. In arguing for a complementarity of diachrony and synchrony, Wieringen declares, neither synchrony nor diachrony is able to get at the intentions of the communication pole, real author. And he follows that assertion immediately with the corresponding pronouncement that neither diachronic exegesis nor synchronic exegesis is able to gain access to the intentions of the communication pole, real reader, regardless as to whether this real reader is a historical first reader or a present reader. Communication presumes intention, even if there is no direct access to it. The occurrence of a writing act intimates an intention to communicate, and the occurrence of a reading act intimates an intention to be communicated to. Part of the expectation of textuality is that the verbal object is a cohesive and complete whole. A key issue in the practice of exegesis is, how are the boundaries of a given verbal object set? How are cohesion and completeness confirmed? Dutch scholar Mario Korpel notes that the principles for selecting passages which form the point of departure for the exegete, in other words, determining the text, are seldom made explicit. Generally, the delimitations of text units are based on content and theme, certain expressions which the interpreter sees as keywords, or the presumed characteristics of a certain literary genre. Inevitably, a certain pre-understanding, she says, often based on modern criteria, influences the choices made, and obviously this may well result in a circular argument. So at the occasion of writing, the producer of a verbal object adjudges the object's boundaries as a reader. Once written, of course, the producer is no longer in control. The case of Isaiah 24 through 27 illustrates Korpel's argument and offers an opportunity to apply Petofi's definition. The segregation of Isaiah 24 through 27 from its textual surroundings is largely a given in Old Testament studies. Marvin Sweeney, for example, describes them as syntactically independent. The primary evidence for this segregation has been the observation of a shift in content and theme. From the particularities of the oracles against the nations in chapters 13 through 23 to the apparent universality of 24 through 27 and the interpretation of the key words, hine in 24:1 and hoi at 28:1, seeing those as discourse markers which constitute boundaries between these chapters and the adjacent textual material. Thus, Isaiah 24 through 27 are regarded as a cohesive, more or less, and complete whole that corresponds to an actual or assumed communicative intention in an actual or assumed communication situation. And when you add the assertion that Bayom Hahu, which occurs seven times in those chapters, is a redactional marker, the chapters become a series of conjoined but discrete communication acts. If so, what was its or their communication situations and intentions? And is there enough text internal evidence to establish these occasions? The distinction between the particularities of the Gentile oracles and the apparent universality of the Isaiah Apocalypse is the result of reading the two sections in relation to each other. It is a reading product, a reader's product. The reader rewrites the text and this rewriting is an intertextuality. Intertextuality is a term whose coining is almost unanimously attributed to Yulia Kristeva. It occurs in the context of her definition of text. She writes, the text is defined, and this one's complicated, as a translinguistic apparatus that redistributes the order of language by relating communicative speech to different kinds of anterior, prior, or synchronic utterances. The text is therefore a productivity, and this means, first, that its relationship to the language in which it is situated is redistributive, and second, that it is a permutation of texts, an intertextuality. In the space of a given text, several utterances taken from other texts intersect and neutralize each other. For Kristeva and her fellow travelers, texts are more than written artifacts, but written artifacts are texts. It seems to me that the term intertextuality is intended, insofar as Kristeva's intention is accessible. Her intention is to oppose or resist the notion that any text is an absolute object. Textuality is no inherent characteristic. Intertextuality summarizes the interior processing that goes on in the exterior or external procedure of communication. All texts are intertextualities. In the frequently quoted words of Roland Barthes, a text is a tissue of quotations drawn from innumerable centers of culture. Further, wrote Barthes, a text is made of multiple writings, drawn from many cultures and entering into mutual relations of dialogue. But there is one place where this multiplicity is focused, and that place is the reader, not the author. The reader is the space on which all the quotations that make up a writing are inscribed. A text's unity lies not in its origin, but in its destination. A writer is, first, a reader. The sensing of an experience, whether actually or by imagination, is a reading act. The experience itself is, as it were, a text. So the experience of it is a reading act, or at least a reading-like act. And any accompanying or subsequent reflection on or recording of the experience is a writing act. The reading of a text affects the text and, in effect, writes a new derivative text. The textual artifact is not changed, but the representation is not the artifact. As soon as you drive an automobile off the dealer's lot, it depreciates. As soon as an experience has taken place, access to it depreciates. Even for an eyewitness, the description of the experience is different. It is other than the experience itself because the teller, actually now a reteller, selects phenomena of the experience and in the telling selects signifiers, words, and arranges them syntactically to stand in for the phenomena. These signifiers and their arrangements have no immediate correspondence. They are not reducible to the event itself. Rather, they grow out of the reteller's prior experiences and communications, and the associations, in Barthes' words, mutual relations of dialogue, the associations that the reteller makes with the current experience. The same is true of what I'll call a thought experience. Since tomorrow with the theological symposium, there's a possibility that one of the physicists will talk about thought experiments, I figured I should dodge that term. A thought experience and its retelling may include events or situations apart from their actual occurrence in space and time, through imagination or assumption or analysis. These processes consider established patterns or understandings and apply them to create experiences of higher or lower possibility or probability, and in the record of this thought experience, the reteller anticipates as in any record or retelling, that the recipients will have sufficient background, acquaintance with the established patterns and understandings, sufficient background to understand the possible or probable experiences, and to respond in accordance with the purposes communicated in the retelling. Text linguistics recognizes, in a way that most historically oriented textual scholarship has not, more possible relations between utterance time, the time when something is spoken, event time, the time or occasion of the events being described, and even narrative or discourse time, so that what a text is about can be different from when it is written or told, and can vary in the way that it is told. This recognition, together with the very opaque, if not downright invisible, referentiality of biblical prophetic discourse, raises doubt about the designation of such discourse, as in Isaiah 24 through 27, as prophecies after the fact. That a telling or retelling takes place implies a reason for telling, the dimension of pragmatics. And this reason for the telling also will influence the selection and arrangement of signs. To the extent that a teller reckons that he will share with those who will hear or read the telling certain characteristics such as language and history and worldview, he will not feel compelled to make every detail explicit. If he anticipates a high correspondence between himself and his audience, he will be able to leave gaps and use coded language. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more for Monty Python fans. Coded language which he expects will be properly filled in and decoded. The lower the correspondence between the teller and those who encounter the telling, in other words, the greater the distance in culture, space, and time, the more difficult it becomes to fill in the gaps and to solve the codes. In short, to arrive at understanding and accordingly to respond. We are long-distance recipients of the textual artifacts of the Old Testament. And because our native correspondence with the writers of the Old Testament is low, these artifacts reveal, but they also conceal, and perhaps even more. We seek to raise our correspondence, our reading competence, by language study, not only at the word and sentence levels, but also for larger linguistic structures, and by studies in history, religion, archaeology, and other soft sciences, but what we attain always remains partial and provisional. Barthes' innumerable centers of culture include the language in which a text is situated. And for the language in which Isaiah 24 through 27 is situated, Hebrew, its verbal system is an ongoing challenge. Whether and how biblical Hebrew grammaticalizes tense and aspect has not been conclusively answered. So, for example, Isaiah 24:1 begins with a construction, hine, plus an intervening term, plus a participle. The intervening term, that I'll simply call X, may or may not be present. This construction occurs 16 times in book Isaiah, and of these, 9 of them, the X term incorporates some kind of reference to Yahweh, either Yahweh, Adon Yahweh Tzevaoth, Yom Yahweh, Shem Yahweh, and so forth. In treating the syntax of participles, Waltke and O'Connor describe the use of the so-called futurum instans participle, often introduced by hine, to indicate imminency. Oswalt, commentator on Isaiah, follows this use in translating chapter 24, verse 1. Behold, the Lord is about to empty the earth. Wildberger, on the other hand, refers to the presentative use of hine and translates the verbless clause as a simple or perhaps omnitemporal present. Behold, Yahweh ravages the earth, a use which Waltke and O'Connor explicitly apply to the same construction at Isaiah 3:1 and translate, the Lord is now taking from Jerusalem. Oswalt and Wildberger are consistent in their translations at 3:1 and 24:1. The begged question is, what textual features, if any, referee between the possible uses identified by Waltke and O'Connor? Translation decisions are reading decisions, and reading decisions are intertextual. Our distance from the Old Testament text is not simply linguistic. It involves every signifying practice at every level. So the burden remains on us to learn how larger word complexes are combined and structured. For if the structures which have seemed awkward to modern readers would have been awkward also to previous, even original readers, it stands to reason that the writer would have modified what is awkward to serve his communicative purpose, which might be why John Barton admitted that the redactor disappears. As George Clooney's character, Ulysses Everett McGill, frequently observed in "O Brother, Where Art Thou?" "Damn, we're in a tight spot." Alkier proposes an approach to biblical studies in terms of text immanent and text external perspectives, with a priority on text immanent investigation, which he writes inquires after the syntactics, semantics, and pragmatics of the text as a world for itself, under the widest possible methodological exclusion of its intertextual and text external relationships. I call this, he says, the world of the text, independence. I call this world of the text, independence upon C.S. Pierce's concept, the universe of discourse of the text. I call the external relationships of the text, independence upon Umberto Eco, its encyclopedic relationships. The encyclopedia is the cultural framework in which the text is situated and from which the gaps of the text are filled. The level of the universe of discourse involves the world assumptions, values, and legalities that the perceptible signs of the text introduce. For the hermeneutical and exegetical community of Concordia Seminary, this describes, I hope, what James Vells has termed reading on level one, the marks on the page, and reading on level two, the events, situations, and circumstances depicted in the textual world. In contrast to the universe of discourse, the encyclopedia, says Alkier, is the codified knowledge of a given culture. To a great extent, this requires not only intertextual competence, but also extratextual competence, including, for example, the knowledge of codes of conduct, geographical, societal, and political knowledge, and so forth. The level of the encyclopedia involves the intertextual and extratextual opening of the structure of the universe of discourse of a given text. And here's a crucial point. After one decides to order the text to a particular encyclopedia, encyclopedic investigation can begin. This, I think, overlaps, it's not sort of coterminous, with what Vells names reading on level three. To the extent that a reading relies on level one and level two signifiers, the reading remains intratextual. To the extent, however, that such reading turns to intertextual and extratextual elements, the encyclopedia, the resultant meanings come much more under the influence of the reader, the one who decides to order the text to a particular encyclopedia. Moreover, these encyclopedias are not givens. Rather, they are themselves intertextualities, products of readings. Todd Hibbard, in Intertextuality in Isaiah 24 through 27, asserts, "Among those who date the text early, the primary factor seems to be a desire to connect this text in some way to the historical Isaiah of the 8th century. Subsequently, however," he admits, "given that I have adopted a methodology in this study that relies on a diachronic arrangement of texts, any ambiguity about Isaiah 24 through 27's date of composition could undermine my argument or arguments about intertextual connections. So, if I now write, among those who date the text late or later, the primary factor seems to be a desire to disconnect this text from the historical Isaiah, or to connect this text to an anonymous 6th century or later prophet, my writing echoes Hibbard's and is an intertextual, though contradictory, reading." Hibbard's Encyclopedia includes common notions about the overall textuality of the Old Testament, lengthy processes of production, accompanied by expansions and rearrangements. But are these notions actually part of an encyclopedia which belongs to any of the possible periods of the text's production? Alkier exhorts an approach that begins with intratextual investigation and proceeds to the other steps. It needs to be recognized, however, that the practice of reading will be more likely a continual circulation between text immanent, intertextual, and text external observations. Readers are always susceptible to veer into level three reading while still engaged in the tasks of securing the sense of the text and appropriating the significance of the events and situations depicted by the text. So also, it can be expected to be difficult to suspend one's intertextual sensitivities and extratextual knowledge to attend with the greatest possible particularity to intratextual exploration. The more influential practice in biblical scholarship seems likely to continue using a more or less universal encyclopedia that flattens the distinctions between biblical Israel and the other nations of the biblical era. In religious practice, for example, apparent similarities weigh more in the balance than the differences. And this notion of flattening holds, I think, for the exile as a kind of formal and material principle of the Hebrew Bible. If the exile was bad for Judah, in my view, it has become worse for subsequent readers and interpreters. That it was a catastrophic event, no one can doubt. To claim that it is somehow the referent for every Old Testament malady, and indeed the impulse for the formation of the Hebrew Bible as such, is by no means assured. Once the exile takes place, it certainly becomes paradigmatic, and as a result, intertextually, it can influence the reading of the whole Old Testament. But the exile is not necessary to the understanding of the text that the Bible presents in pre-exilic context, such as Isaiah 24 through 27. As readers of the Old Testament, First Testament, Hebrew Bible, we live in at least two universes of discourse. One formed by the Guild of Exegetical Scholarship, the other by shared, to greater or lesser degrees, shared theological understandings and commitments. My present impression is that semiotic approaches offer a way to reambiguate some of the seemingly assured results of the Guild, to reintroduce as intellectually plausible interpretations which have been neglected, and to write our readings in a way that is congenial to our commitments. Thank you.